This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today we have with us
Alison Milton
and Maurice Clark.
So Maurice, last episode we were talking about Mason Jury and the impact that he had had for you on some of your training.
Well, it was the combined session that he did with Hapai Winiata. Now, and interestingly, Hapai Winiata was the curate at St Luke's Church out in Kairanga when I was a teenager. So he was an interesting man. He had come into the Anglican ministry. He was a shearer and used to work around the farms, and then had gone into the church and he came out to St Luke's as our curate for a while. So that was where I'd first met him. And then he ended up becoming a bishop. He was a pretty amazing man, but I've never forgotten the session that he and Sir Mason Jury did together during our block, because it made me think about how I could make a difference for all of the Maori people that I worked with, because when I graduated from the nursing course, it was a really interesting situation, not too dissimilar to what we've got now, where graduate nurses were not being employed, and out of my class, there were only five of us employed into the hospital. I was lucky enough to be one of them.
Wow.
And I was employed to work in the oncology ward, because with what had happened with my cousin, I had an understanding of what it was like to be on the family side as well as the professional side. And in those days there was no hospice. This is pre-hospice. So this is 1984, 83, 84, when I graduated. And just a little aside there, back in those days before we could sit our state finals, we used to have to sit hospital exams as well. So we had 3 hours. Three exams, each 3 hours, one a medical paper, one a surgical paper, and an obstetric paper, because we had to deliver babies back in those days, because midwifery was a postgraduate qualification for a registered nurse back then. This was before the split away and to set the separate courses for midwives. And then we had to pass those hospital finals before we were allowed to sit our state exams. Okay, so we had nine hours worth of exams in the hospital, and were you good enough to sit your finals? Yes, you were. Then we had our state finals, and we had three-hour exams, medicine, surgery, obstetrics for our state. So we sat 18 hours worth of exams in order to qualify. You had to pass every single one of those papers in order to get your New Zealand registration. And I remember going and sitting the medical paper, and I came home from it and went, oh my God, I have failed. I don't think I'm going to go back and sit the rest of the papers. But I did. I went back and I sat them, and I passed. But interestingly, that year, for the first time ever, there was an enormous fail amongst the students of Palmerston North Hospital. And to this day, myself and the class I came from believe that it was a political fail, because they were wanting to put They were wanting to shut down the hospital schools of nursing, and Palmerston North had never had a fail like this. And when I look at my colleagues who didn't pass their exams,
yes,
these were intelligent, articulate, capable people.
Yes.
And they didn't pass.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
One of them's now the lawyer for the Nursing Council of New Zealand. Mm, so we to this day, firmly believe that there was a bit of a political
move.
Jiggery-pokery going on there. And that made it really sad, because those of us who had passed, we couldn't really celebrate.
No.
Because half our class hadn't passed.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, as an aside to that, where they weren't employing much in the way of nurses at that point. And as I said, only five of us got employed. And we had a great egress of nurses overseas, which is what we're seeing
now.
Again, now with, you know, there's just this whole cycle that goes on. And this is, and so this was 1984 that happened.
Right.
And we lost some very, very good nurses overseas. Some of them never came back. And we can't afford to keep doing this to our nursing students.
No.
But I was lucky enough to get employed and go into the oncology setting. And this was in the days before there was a hospice. So we were doing both the curative and the palliative treatment in the ward at the time, and we did all we had the radiation, the radium insertions for the CA cervixes. But the other thing that we used to do was the nurses, they devised a course for nurses to administer chemotherapy.
Wow.
So a few of us, it was a brand new groundbreaking course, and our charge nurse directed a few of us into it. I was one of the ones that did it. And so we were the first nurses to be administering IV chemotherapy. We had to do some really serious assignments and research, because Dr. Bitter and Dr. Cordery had set the course up, and so we had assignments to do on the drugs. We had to know the drugs inside out, upside down and back to front, and then had an oral exam with the consultant to do it. So you had to go in and answer these questions on the spot. But managed to pass that, and so was certificated to one of the first nurses in the hospital, certificated to give chemotherapy while I was working there. But we did all of the drawing up of those drugs in a laminar flow unit in the ward. Now all of that is done in pharmacy in a very controlled environment.
Wow. What rich learning you've had, though, haven't you, in your whole course? Rich learning. Hasn't it?
Yeah.
Curative, palliative, spiritual.
And so that going back to that spiritual stuff, that sounds terrible. We had the catchment area for the oncology services is a regional one. It's not just local. So we were pulling from Gisborne, Whanganui, right up to past Taihape, down to Otaki, all down the Wairarapa. And so there are significant Māori populations in those areas, and they were overrepresented in the oncology setting, quite often coming in with really serious advanced cancers because of lack of access to services and such like. And so what we were taught with that session from Hapai Winiata and Sir Mason Jury was absolutely invaluable in working in that oncology space, because you've got the physical and the spiritual there, and just the impact of them. And this was back in the days before we had Māori chaplains in the ward, and it was back before we had the Māori Health Directorate and the Paiora teams. Mm. There was a real lack of acknowledgement in the system in those days of the need to provide that level of support. Mm. During that time, the hospice movement was beginning. Mm. June Connor and who else was it? June Connor was the key driver. She was an oncology nurse and district nurse, and was very passionate about the hospice model. And there was a doctor as well. And June and he were the two people that spearheaded the development of Arohanuk Hospice. And once the hospice was developed, then the lot of the palliative work that we were doing in the oncology setting went out. But that was after I'd finished working there, because by this point I was married, and I got a little bit pregnant. just slightly. And I had to move out of the oncology setting because of the drugs and the radiation, because they have tetragenic effects, and I could have had a fried baby.
Yeah.
So they sent me to work in the maternity unit, and I think I've always said they sent me to work over there in the postnatal wards to make sure that I knew which end to put the baby's nappy on. But there was an interesting experience over there as well, because of course in the maternity unit they deal with life. Yes. Everything's about the living.
Yeah.
But some babies don't live.
No, they don't.
And I was all of about 27, 28, maybe 29 weeks pregnant, was in that and coming into work, and I arrived in the ward. Oh, right, we've given you Mrs. So-and-so to look after today. Her baby's in the the neonatal unit, and he's a 28, 29 weeker, and he's not going to live. We've given him to you because you've got experience with dealing with dying. And I'm standing there going, hang on a minute. I am roughly the same stage of pregnancy as this young woman is. How appropriate is it for me? But no, they wouldn't have a bar of it. So.
Wow.
Yeah, that was probably one of the hardest things I've done in my nursing career, is to look after this young woman. And I think the saddest thing was when I went in to see her, you know, she'd had her baby, she was in her side room all by herself.
Mm.
Nobody had taken her down to see that baby.
And
so that was one of the first things
I did
was organise for her to see her baby so she could hold her baby and all that kind of stuff. And she was worried that it was something she had done that had caused her to lose the baby, and I'm standing there still obviously pregnant going, actually, no, it's not anything you've done. These things do happen. And yeah, in the end, it worked out because, you know, I used my brain and such like. But I've never forgotten the inappropriateness of that.
Mm.
That they, because the staff didn't want to deal with the fact the baby was dying.
Mm.
Oh, you've come from an oncology ward. You know how to deal with dying.
You can deal with it.
I was 23.
Yes. Yeah.
But anyway, we did it.
But the other side of that too was, You are a person that is very rich with compassion and understanding, and, you know, the lady was blessed also to have you there with her, as hard as it was for you. You know, she was blessed to have you.
It was hard for her.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because you're looking at someone else and I also got myself into quite a bit of trouble with the charge nurse there, because I believed in patient education. It wasn't with this young lady, but there were lots of young women who had cesareans, and they were asking about it. They were asking about, you know, what had happened with their cesareans and things. Mm. So I brought my textbooks in with the pictures in, so that they knew. And the charge nurse was horrified that I'd brought this information, and we can't have you scaring these. And I'm going,
it's real.
But they want to know what has happened to them, and I've got bodies. The images here. It's their bodies, yes. So, gee, it was funny. The poor charge nurse was mortified that these people were getting the information they needed about what had happened to them and why they were feeling like they'd been run over by a steam train.
And here's the nurse educator.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the blossoming nurse educator. How you became a nurse educator.
Oh, that was a few years down the track. So after I had my first child, I worked, so from about 1985, for about 7 years I worked casual.
Mm.
That meant I went anywhere and everywhere in the hospital, but a lot of that time I was called into when they had... like no senior staff on a ward, so you'd be called in to pick up a shift and run the ward.
Mm.
I have, to this day, have always been eternally grateful to enrolled nurses, because whenever I came on duty into a ward that I hadn't been on for a while, I'd walk into the ward, and if I saw the ward enrolled nurse was there, I knew things would be all right, because I knew that enrolled nurse, 9 times out of 10, knew what was going on in a ward, because at that stage, this was when the polytechnic was fully up and running, and the newly minted registered nurses coming out of the polytechs were struggling in the clinical settings, because by the time we had finished our training, we were so familiar with the wards. We'd been running shifts and all that kind of stuff. By crikey, we were dumped into things sometimes. But you learned to be resilient. And you learned to rely on your skills and your judgment. So by the time I registered, the only thing I wasn't doing was giving IV medications. But everything else, we ran wards. We coordinated shifts. We did all sorts. Whereas the poor guys coming in from the tech, they had no experience of that, and they used to be terrified. And you'd come on to a ward of the newly minted polytech nurses, and they were struggling. And it was cruel to them. And so I always knew whenever I got called in, and that was the situation, if there was an enrolled nurse on the ward, I'd be able to figure out what was going on and what I was supposed to be doing. Because sometimes, you know, I was coming in partway through a shift and picking it up and running it. And, you know, it was... And I also, during that time, did that 7 years, I did a lot of morning and afternoon supervising as well across the hospital. And it was also during that time I started doing some postgrad study out at NASA. I'd begun to do a Bachelor of Nursing, but my pregnancy hadn't gone as straightforward as it could have, and so things got put on hold for a bit. But also in that time, I qualified as a Plunket nurse, and I worked part-time in the community for Plunket during that period as well. So I had the Ashurst Pohongana Aokautere run. Absolutely loved it. Because it was a rural run. And you're working with people in their own homes.
Yes.
And on their terms, and most of them are well.
Yes.
You get to go to some interesting places. Like the one where the young lady said to me, whatever you do, she says, do not get out of the car. I will come and open the gate, because there were these really rabid dogs at her property. They were the boyfriend's dogs.
Oh.
I know now, in hindsight, it was a drug house.
Yeah.
So I'd go in, and there was the dodgy partner in the garden giving you the look.
The look.
Know, it's all right. He just doesn't like people. I'm going, you're okay. Yeah. There you are, talking to mum and examining the baby, and the bloody dogs are trying to get him through the wall. I look back, we were, and of course, again, no cell phones, nothing like that.
So we
did go and get put in some really interesting situations.
Yes.
going back to when I was a student nurse, I went out with the public health nurse, Jess, over in Fielding, and she was an old school nurse, and she says to me this day, right, we're going to go up above Kimbolton, Marie, she says, we're going to visit a couple of sisters up there who are very reclusive, etc., etc. They don't really like having new people around, so just be aware they might present a shotgun when
okay.
And then she goes, and whatever you do, do not accept a cup of tea while you're there. Okay, so we couldn't get up there, and bless them, these two ladies, they were twin sisters, and they were very, very eccentric. They were in their own world, and they were hoarders, and the house was just packed ceiling to floor, and you had to go. And I could see why Jess had said, don't have a cup of tea. But, you know, and you just learn to go with the flow when you have those sorts of experiences. Yeah. So yes, I am a Plunkett nurse as well as a registered nurse. So the Plunkett nursing was my first postgraduate qualification, and then when I had my second child, I came back to work full time after that because I needed to support the family because that's just how it was. I was the employable one.
Yeah.
So I came back to work when she was 5 months old into full time in one of the acute medical wards, and so from there I've worked in acute general medicine, acute general surgery, cardiology, done a little bit of orthopaedics, medical and surgical high dependency, and it was during the time that I was up in the surgical ward, I got shoulder tapped and asked to become to go into a temporary secondment, a 6 week temporary secondment, because the director of nursing wanted to develop an educator, a nursing education role in the hospital. She was familiar with it in overseas settings, and she could see the need because there was no program around supporting new graduates into the setting. We were losing staff because of the culture shock they were experiencing when they came.
I was going
in.
To ask you that. Yeah.
An enormous culture shock because, in the programs, they were often only working Monday to Friday, 7 to 3 or 8 to 4:30. They might get afternoon shifts towards the end of their training. So when they came into rostered rotating shifts and the reality of the clinical settings, it destroyed them. They also, unlike us, they hadn't been mentored into the RN role as part of their training. So they'd gone from student to registered nurse. Student, while you're responsible and accountable for your practice, the ultimate responsibility lies with the RN. When you're the registered nurse, you are the Johnny on the spot, and it's you who is responsible and accountable for your patient outcomes and well-being and all that kind of stuff. And was terrifying for a lot of them, and they were having difficulty applying their theory into the practice setting as well. So there she could see a need in the acute medical ward, and I've got the acute medical background. So temporary secondment for 6 weeks. And here we are 20 plus years later. So I started out on one ward, and then it grew, and I remember the surgeons were very interested in this because, I was up in the surgical ward at this point, and they were a little bit perturbed that, she'd been pulled out of there and came down to find out what I was doing, and when they heard what the role was, we need something like that in the surgical wards as well. And so eventually the one temporary role, there is now an educator team at the hospital, and because for a while there was just me, and that was interesting, being the one and only.
Yes,
because there was a lot of folks out there that didn't think that there should be such a role, and I should just get back onto the floor and be a real nurse. And then there were was the staff bureau that thought you were the senior nurse fill-in person for the hospital, and you know, you get rung at 6 o'clock in the morning. Mm. Oh, we need you to come into work at 7 o'clock and go to ward X. The charge nurse is off sick there. You need to run the ward. Yeah. And so there was this pulling and pushing. And I mean, it eventually got sorted out, but it took many years for people to stop using educators as the gap fillers and such like.
Mm.
Yeah. So now there's a team. There's I'm just trying to think. I think there's about 20, maybe about 15 to 20 educators now. Mm. Not all full time. I'm one of the full timers, and they, you know, they're across mental health, maternity, child health, medicine, surgery, oncology, you know, and we they do staff support in the wards, and they do they oversee the education and competencies of the staff. The charge nurse is ultimately responsible for the standards of practice in the ward.
Mm.
So the educator's not a ward manager.
Right.
The educator works alongside the charge nurse. Mm, they're a co-equal branch,
right.
if you like.
Mm.
And we also teach in classroom settings and things like that. So, yeah.
Really good. Really huge progress through through the years.
So that's
too.
20...
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms.
Thank you for listening to Manuel.
Google Podcasts and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz
People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manuel website.
For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.
govt.nz